From WXXI News, I'm Frank Sigelski, and this is Connections. Hey, everyone. Evan Dawson is out today. Again, I'm Frank Sigelski, and on this hour of Connections, we welcome Leah Gunn Barrett, Executive Director of New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. She's here in studio in advance of her public appearance tonight. Leah is, again, the Executive Director of New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. Prior to that, she was a dean and adjunct lecturer at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. She lived for 14 years in London, where she held senior management positions with Data Resources Europe, The Economist Group, and Tetra Pak UK. As executive director of Ceasefire Maryland, the statewide gun violence prevention group, she led efforts for an assault weapons ban. Sadly, Leah lost her older brother, Greg, to gun violence in 1997. She also holds a BA from Carleton College in economics and Russian, a master's in international affairs and Russian from Columbia University, and a master's in teaching from Johns Hopkins University. Fantastic. All right. Leah, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you for coming in. And again, you're working your butt off, and thank you for that. And there are folks who are all over the spectrum on this issue, and we expect them to call. And if they disagree with you, they'll go to the head of the line. But why don't we get started? Tell us about how it is that you're sitting here today. And what is keeping you going and what's on your agenda?
Well, I'll start with the story, my own personal story, how I got involved in gun violence prevention. You mentioned the death of my brother in 1997. I was living in London with my family and got the phone call from one of my brothers, I had four brothers, that Greg had been shot in the head that morning at his business in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So he was essentially brain dead, and I flew back on the first flight the next morning to Tulsa and was with him when they turned off the life support machine. He was 40 years old and had two kids. His daughter was 15, his son was just 13, and his wife of 17 years. So this was a huge blow to my family, obviously. And I went back to London, and we moved back, my family and I moved back to the United States at the end of 1999, and we moved to the D.C. area where my husband was a professor. And I got involved in the Million Mile March, which is just starting to form the volunteer group, and took part in that with my daughter. She was only four at the time. And then I got involved with a state group in Maryland called Ceasefire Maryland. And when the executive director stepped down, I became the executive director and did that job for 3 years and worked on the assault weapons ban, which failed just by one vote back then. But now Maryland did pass it after Newtown, which I'm pleased to recognize. And then we moved, my family and I moved to New York in 2010, and I got re-involved. I knew about New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. I had worked with them when I was in Maryland. State groups tend to work together. And I joined the board, and then my predecessor resigned, and the position opened up, and I thought I would try it again. I would get back into the issue because I care very deeply about it. I care what's happening to Americans. I care what's happening in particular to our children with gun violence, and I wanted to try to make a difference.
Okay, so. Well, fantastic. And again, if you want to join the show, 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255. I should also mention that we have another gentleman here. Gary Puttup is Lieutenant Gary Puttup, retired from the Sheriff's Department. He's been working with you on your visit here, as has his wife. And so, Gary, welcome. You've been here before.
Good afternoon, Frankie. And I got to tell you, I like the beard. It looks good.
Okay. All right. It's okay. I have one of those special trimming things. So, you know, I don't look like Abraham Lincoln like I did in college. I had a beard in college. I didn't know you could actually trim it. Like, yeah. You're supposed to trim it. So anyway, all right. So, it's so hard to know where to go into this issue, but you've probably heard a good number of arguments about, you know, the Second Amendment and, you know, the clash there and the stand your ground laws and all that. Is there, in your view, is there any room for guns in our society? Is there any place for them?
Oh, absolutely. And there's always been room from the very founding of our nation. From, you know, the militias, you had to have a musket if you were an able-bodied white male between certain ages, to defend your town. The colonies relied on militias. There wasn't a standing army. So guns have always been part of our culture. That goes without saying. But what's also been part of our culture from the very beginning are gun regulations. Very early days of the colonies. You couldn't, if you were Catholic, you couldn't have a gun. If you were African-American, you couldn't have a gun. If you were a traitor to the country or deemed to be a traitor, you couldn't own a gun. So there were limits on who could actually own guns. During colonial periods, guns were actually not stored in the home because there was a danger of them exploding from the black powder because they were muskets. So there was usually a central storage place on the village green, typically where people would have their guns. And if the militia was called out to do service, they would come and collect their guns and they'd have training there. We've had gun laws throughout our history. In the 19th century, people like to evoke the Wild Wild West. Well, I'm from Kansas originally. And there's a very famous photograph of Dodge City, Kansas in the 19th century showing a sign at the city limit saying, no firearms allowed beyond this point. You certainly couldn't bring your guns into saloons because alcohol and firearms were a very toxic mix then, as they are now. Mm-hmm. So there have always been gun regulations, and people need to reacquaint themselves with our history. And no right from the Bill of Rights and the Second Amendment is the second amendment in that 10 Bill of Rights. And there's no right that's absolute. I mean, the freedom of speech and press, we have libel laws, we have slander laws, you can't scream fire in a crowded theater. So with rights come responsibilities, and all rights are necessarily limited because we live in a society with other people, and people have a right to own firearms, but I also have a right not to be shot.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, it's interesting. Two of the regulations, well said. Two of the early regulations that you mentioned, if you were Catholic or African-American, you couldn't own a gun. So those who support or are against gun regulations could say, there have been lots of bad gun regulations, just like the ones that many people are proposing now. Does that carry any weight?
Well, we like to see, the Second Amendment exists, and I think, you know, we don't need to get bogged down in that. Mm-hmm. But what we can really look at is we can look at gun violence in the United States as a public health issue. Like we have looked at traffic accidents, like death from smoking, and other things that affect a broad range of our citizens. It's a fact that about 32,000 Americans die every year from guns. Two-thirds of those deaths are actually suicides using a gun. A gun is a very effective way to commit suicide. You have about an 85% success rate with a gun, mm-hmm. whereas other methods combined is about a 5% a success rate, and those are data from the Harvard School of Public Health. It's not just homicides, it's not just criminals, it's suicide, it's domestic violence, it's accidental shootings as well. In addition to the 32,000 deaths every year, we have about 80,000 Americans being injured from guns. And if you just look at the costs of that, there are some very well-known studies. Jens Ludwig from the University of Chicago published a book years ago looking at the costs of gun violence, and he estimated them to be about $100 billion a year. And that's just not hospital costs, health care costs. It's social costs, lost wages, psychological costs, the cost to society, really, of what this daily scourge of violence is doing to us as a society.
Okay. Lee Gunn Barrett is our guest for this hour of Connections. And if you want to join the show, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. And again, you'll be speaking at the First Universalist Church tonight at 7 p.m. And that's open to the public, is it, Leah?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, fantastic. All right, so we'll mention that again. Can we, what is the disconnect between folks like the NRA and others and other folks like such as yourself? Where are we? It's a miscommunication. What's going on? Why can't we get our heads around this? Why is there so much animosity when we get into this issue? I mean, what's the problem?
I think there's a lot of misrepresentation. You have to remember that the National Rifle Association, which actually started as an organization after the Civil War to improve marksmanship of soldiers, because the generals during the Civil War on both the Union and the Confederate side were a bit appalled at how badly people took aim and fired. Their marksmanship wasn't very good. So they set up the National Rifle Association to help address that. They provided training and safety. And then later it became aligned with hunter safety. When I was growing up in the 60s and 70s in Kansas, it was very much known as an organization that focused mainly on hunter safety. Mm-hmm. And that was fine. But I think what happened is there's a very good book out by Michael Waldman called The Second Amendment, a biography that was just published. And he's the head of the Brennan Center at NYU. And he's looking back at the history of the Second Amendment. And there was actually a radical change in leadership at the National Rifle Association around 1977. The leadership had been planning to move the organization to Colorado to headquarter it there and to focus more on, you know, the outdoors aspects
the
of sporting, gun
ownership. The sporting
That's right.
uses of
guns. That's
gun
right. But there was, a bit of a boardroom coup, and some more extreme individuals took over who felt that it was necessary to make the National Rifle Association much much more about individual rights to own a gun and handguns and other weapons other than hunting rifles. And they went about it in a very systematic way, convincing the public that ownership of a handgun in the home was protecting your family, it's your right to self-defense. All the data, however, show that owning a handgun in the home, you're 22 times more likely to injure yourself, kill yourself or someone you know or love than to repel a home invader. So, but they were successful at convincing the public that this was indeed the case. And you saw public opinion change from a handgun does not protect me in the home to it, yes, it does. Despite all the evidence otherwise. And it was also at a time when the gun industry was experiencing a decline in sales. Hunting was declining. The numbers of Americans actually owning guns was going down. So this was actually a way also for the National Rifle Association, which now is essentially an industry organization, to increase gun sales.
You know, yeah, that was, I mean, when I think about this, I you know, again, follow the dollars. You can't sell, you can't make a profit on no guns. You can make a profit on selling weapons, and you know, they're expensive, and you know, how do you deal with that? Well, Gary, Frank, you want to jump in here? Gary, yeah, put up again. You go ahead.
Yeah, Frank, thanks. You know, just to add a little bit to that, and as you said, and as your predecessor Bob Smith used to always like to say, follow the money. At about the same time, the motivation for this coup in the NRA. That in full disclosure, I used to be a life member of the NRA, but I've quit, or as I like to say, the NRA quit me. Because, okay. And again, as a police officer, you know, as a hunter and a gun owner, they've really changed their tune. But so to understand some of the motivation in this, right about that same time, the NRA formed what was called the Institute for Legislative Action, which is their PAC. Up until that time, the primary funding of the NRA came from gun owners like me. I like to hunt, like to target shoot, and maybe even carry a gun for self-defense. And a gun for me, it was off-duty use. What happened when they formed that PAC is they were able to take in large amounts of money. Those large amounts of money, for instance, like Wayne LaPierre makes almost $1 million a year in salary, is paid by the gun industry. Their own magazine, their own publication, American Rifleman, every month publishes where the majority of their funding comes from. And you will see it's from the gun manufacturers, not from people like me, not from the a regular membership. And they've been very successful at convincing the membership, and this is just marketing, to believe that they're representing them. In fact, they're representing the manufacturers. And if I could just explain how that works very quickly. In the past, when we were younger, when I was younger, and I used to hunt and shoot, I might go out and buy a bolt-action rifle, maybe a revolver or a handgun for whatever reason, and unless I put a scope on it and a sling, that was pretty much it. Maybe I'd buy a shotgun to go. I had a shotgun when I used to deer hunt. I'd buy that shotgun. I'd have that for years. And again, maybe I'd put a sight on it. Maybe I'd change a sling, and that was it. I would invite anybody that's not familiar with these to go to Wegmans, excuse me if I name a store, go to the sporting section, and you'll see magazine upon magazine dealing with the AR-15 platformed rifle. And what you'll find in these magazines is accessory upon accessory upon accessory. The industry isn't making as much money on the gun itself as they are on accessories. This is about marketing.
Auto aftermarket.
Yep. It's like a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. It's not the motorcycle that's going to drive you broke. It's the chrome. And this is what has happened. The NRA is now really beholden to this gun industry, and all you have to do is follow the money.
Yeah. So what do we do about that? If that's, you know, that's a, I mean, first of all, I think the issue of disclosure, you know, and the lack of misrepresentation. But is there anything wrong with what they're doing? I mean, that's what other PACs do. What do you say to that?
Well, I think the problem with this special interest, along with other special interests, is the voice of the American people, the majority of voters. Their voices are drowned out by this excessive influence and money. So, for example, when we had polls after Newtown asking about support for something as basic as background checks on gun sales to make sure guns don't fall into the hands of criminals, domestic abusers, seriously mentally ill, 90% of Americans pretty consistently across the country said, yeah, that's a good idea. In fact, the NRA 10 years ago said that's a good idea. And yet we saw in April the vote, and by the way, 75% of NRA members thought that was a good idea too. So with the vote in April in the Senate, April 17th last year, Manchin-Toomey Amendment, which was actually not even universal background checks, it was just background checks on commercial gun sales, so sales on the internet and at gun shows. We have background checks already at sales at FFLs, licensed firearms dealers. That amendment failed by 5 votes in the Senate. So, and that was because a lot of these senators, and 4 of them were Democrats, were afraid of retribution from the industry lobby, the corporate gun lobby, as represented by the National Rifle Association. So they basically bought our representatives. And so the voices of the people are not coming through. And as I say, I get back to this issue. It's a public health crisis, gun violence in America. There needs to be some kind of sensible regulation on guns. Guns are the only consumer product not regulated for consumer health and safety by the Consumer Health Product Safety Commission.
Hmm. Where did they get that exemption?
Congress.
Actually, it's interesting enough, I don't, you know, if the listeners realize this, the gun industry is the only industry in the United States that's immune from lawsuits, liability. Congress passed, and maybe, you know, Leah can help me with the name of the act, where Congress, backed by NRA money, has passed a law where the gun industry can't be sued. Nobody, no other industry. Then when you ask what's the difference between the PACs, how does that work in a free society where a citizen can't go to court and be held equal? There should be equal justice under the law.
Well, there's an analogy. The pharmaceutical industry was also seeking immunity, is what we're talking about, immunity from lawsuits in the development of medications and vaccines for, you know, monkeypox or whatever else was going on. I'm not sure what the status of that
was. Although, Frank, if I may, I think there's a difference between even at that, somebody's trying to heal you as opposed to somebody that's trying to shoot you.
Well, not necessarily.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone should have immunity. I think we should all be held responsible for our negligence and for our intentional acts, whether you're – that's my opinion. But we're not dealing with my opinion.
Yeah, it's
we're
about corporate responsibility,
it's about
really.
Corporate responsibility.
You want to make sure that your supply chain, if you're a gun manufacturer – if I were a gun manufacturer, I'd want to make sure that my distributors and then the dealers who actually sell to the public are obeying the law and they're not willfully selling to gun traffickers. And in fact, we know that that occurs. About 1% of federally licensed gun dealers in the United States are termed so-called bad apples. This was a study done a few years ago. And they're the same ones. So it's just it just takes a few to evade the law and willfully sell guns into the illegal market. And the gun industry knows full well that this is happening. They're doing nothing to stop it. So that, to me, is corporate irresponsibility.
I think maybe a closer comparison in regards to PACs and that. And to answer your question, what do? It's the same thing we did in the 60s and 70s with the tobacco industry. When they had people convinced, so we look at old ads where they had doctors and ads telling people that, well, this is good for your digestion. And so the NRA is telling us and Scope is telling us this is good for you. Well, the way you get past that is you hit them with facts. You hit them with facts and reason. And actually, you know, Leah has some good facts on what has happened in New York since the passage of the SAFE Act. One of the things we hear these people say is the SAFE Act doesn't work, let's get rid of it. Well, first of all, I don't know that any law can be judged after a year. In private industry, we know this, that a business makes it or doesn't make it, it takes 3 years. But even in the short time that the SAFE Act has been in effect in New York, we've seen some significant differences, and Leah can explain those.
Okay, we'll get into those. Again, I want to give the number out, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, if you want to join the show with Leah Gunn Barrett, Executive Director of New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. So what your research shows, what has been the impact of the act?
Let's go back to before New York SAFE passed and look at where New York stands in the 50 states when it comes to its gun safety laws or gun regulations and the numbers of people dying. And the best way to measure that is looking at rates, not absolute numbers, but rates, which is the
adjusted
number
for the population.
Exactly. So if you look at the states with two factors, high gun ownership and weak gun regulation, you'll find that they have the highest rate of gun death rates. So, for example, the number one state is Alaska, and this is per 100,000 people. 20.3 people in Alaska die from guns. Louisiana is number two, 19%. Montana, 16%. And then Alabama and Wyoming, those are the top five for the highest gun death rates in the country. And they all have relatively high gun ownership rates, from 45% over to 60%. And if you look at the states with low gun death rates and reasonably good gun regulations, and New York is amongst those, New York has the fourth lowest gun death rate in the nation. So we have 5.1 deaths per 100,000, which is pretty astonishing given that we are a state of 20 million people and we have about 80 million visitors a year. We're one of the more populous states, and yet we have... So gun laws, strong gun laws actually do work. They do save lives.
What about Chicago?
Chicago, yeah. Chicago is... it does have tough gun laws in the city of Chicago. The problem there is you've got Illinois as a state, doesn't have strong gun laws, so it's very easy for people to go to the suburbs or other cities in Chicago or other states and bring guns and traffic them into the city of Chicago. That's what happens to New York City. But because New York State has stronger gun laws, you're not having any guns being trafficked sort of out of New York State into other states. They're trafficked into New York State.
Oh, actually, Frank, and very often we hear that from people that say, well, what about Chicago? And quite frankly, that is only an argument as to why the state should have strong gun laws. If somebody's using that argument to say that gun laws don't work, that actually is an argument. It's exactly why good statewide gun laws do work.
Okay. Now, how about this? What... You know, let's take the stats. You say 20 people died of gunshot injuries in Alaska or whatever. What if those
20 per 100,000, that's the rate.
Okay, yeah. Let's just say everyone who got killed by a gun in Alaska was a bad guy breaking into a house and a homeowner shot him. What do you say about those 20 then?
But that's not the case.
I know it's not, but do we know it's not? I mean,
well, that's one of the problems. You raise an interesting point, is we actually don't have a lot of information about gun violence, how it's occurring, who's suffering from it. The New York Times did a study, a report just a few months ago on accidental shootings amongst children, and found that that's seriously underreported because there's no standardized way across the country of reporting these kinds of accidents that are happening with kids. And so the reason for this is since 1996, Congress again cut off funding at the request of the corporate gun lobby to reduce any money we were spending through the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, on gun violence research. And so there's basically no money, like $10,000 a year, when it was just a few million going into gun violence research. Because if you don't have good evidence, evidence-based policy, you can't have good policy. And we know this from other industries like tobacco, like traffic, auto safety. You have to have good data, and you have to have public health officials analyzing the data and recommending what makes sense from a public policy and public health standpoint.
Wherever you stand on this issue, you know, it does raise eyebrows when you think that this is an industry that has pushed laws through Congress to immunize itself when no other industry gets that. This is an industry that has passed this TR amendment, which is what Leah is referring to, that specifically prohibits the research. Well, so you got to really wonder, why would someone do that? And I don't care if you're pro-gun, you're anti-gun, or whatever, but you know, it certainly makes you wonder, like, why would someone pass a law, spend millions to lobby to pass a law to say we don't want to know the answer?
Yeah. All right, let's go quickly to the phones. We have Pete in Rochester. Pete, welcome to Connections. You're on the air.
Good morning. Seeing that we recognize that of the 32,000-plus gun deaths in, I think it was 2012, more than 19,000 were suicides. So then would we have an agreement that the first step we should take as a society is a universal comprehensive healthcare system that includes mental health services? And when you consider that 22 of those suicides per day are service members.
Hmm. Well, Pete, and
good question. Thank you for the call.
Yeah, Pete, and it's good to hear from you again. You're absolutely correct. And one of the things that I think that it's important to realize too, and we'll hear this again from the gun industry, Scope, and the NRA, that we need to pay attention to these mental health issues. Nobody's disputing that. We certainly are not. New Yorkers Against Gun Violence and me, we don't dispute. Yes, we need better health. We need mental health services. Yes, we need to look at that. But, you know, to think that that's the panacea, that's going to end what, you know, what's going on. And here's one in particular in case, is women are disproportionately the victims of gun violence. A woman who is involved with a domestic abuse situation where the partner owns a gun is 5 times more likely to die. Right? That's not a mental health issue. So let's look at mental health. Let's do all that. Let's spend the resources. Let's do the research. But that's not the whole answer.
All right. Why don't we continue? Let's go to Bernard in Fairport. Bernard, welcome to Connections. You're on the air.
Thank you. And I really appreciate this conversation because I think what I'm hearing as a theme is rationalism. I mean, whether you're for or against guns is kind of the extreme. The focus that we need to have in our society, and as you said, there's a lot of people spending money to basically defeat rationalism because it benefits them. But to think that everyone in the United States should have, even if they could have, a 30 bullet gun that they can carry down the street and smoke cigarettes, it just seems to me that our society has kind of moved away from rationalism. And that's what I like about this conversation. You folks are being rational. But when you get into the discussion with somebody about these kinds of topics, their strategy is to go irrational so that you're threatening their freedom and so on and so forth. So it seems to me that this conversation needs to go forth, but it also needs to expand to the idea of we need to deal with the world in a rational basis, specifically in the government. And I appreciate the conversation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We got the lines lighting up here, but we're going to have to take a short break, just a minute, so stick around, continue listening. Again, our guest is Leah Gunn-Barrett, also Lieutenant Gary Puttup, retired from the Sheriff's Department, is here, and we're talking about gun control, et cetera, et cetera. I'm Frank Sigelski, filling in for Evan Dawson today on Connections on WXXI, WEOS, the WXXI mobile app, and WXXINews.org. Coming up in our second hour of Connections, legendary real estate expert, author, and columnist Edith Lenk visits in studio. She'll share her real estate expertise and other wisdom acquired over a multi-decade career. Have your questions and comments ready for Edith Lenk. It's all coming up in our second hour on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Niagara Wine Trail USA, 20 wineries starting in western Monroe County between Rochester and Niagara Falls, flanked by Lake Ontario and the Niagara Escarpment. Niagara Wine Trail, uncork a natural wonder. NiagaraWineTrail.org.
Sometimes the way the economy is doing can be summed up in just a couple of numbers.
We've never dreamed of $2 a pound cattle, and they were well over $2 a pound.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Supply, Demand, and Cows, next time on Marketplace from APN.
Marketplace tonight at 6:30 p.m. on your public radio station, WXXI and WEOS.
And continuing on Connections, I'm Frank Sigelski. Evan Dawson is out today. Our guest for this hour is Leah Gunn-Barrett, Executive Director of New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. Also, Gary Puttup is here. Why don't we go to the phones again, because we have someone waiting patiently. If you want to join the show, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. And we have Keith from Henrietta. Keith, welcome to Connections. You're on the air.
Frank, interesting show. I just want to bring up several points. Has anybody ever documented the cost of gun violence financially to the healthcare? Because most gun violence, especially the wounded, there's no insurance for it. The taxpayers ultimately pick it up. Personally, I believe all guns should be registered, just like you register your car. Somebody steals my car, it causes injury to them, they can sue me, my insurance company will step in, and I think guns should be handled the exact same way. I have friends who are, I call gun nuts, they say gun control works, does it work? And I say, yes, it does. I said, I can prove it. They chuckle, and I said, when was the last time you heard anybody killed in this country with a machine gun? Machine guns are made, but they're still controlled. And I think they should tax the living hell out of ammunition, reloading supplies, push it to offset the costs that are incurred, medically speaking, from gun violence.
Okay. All right. Appreciate the call. You're breaking up a bit there on your phone, but I think we have the gist of it, and appreciate the call.
Yeah, you make a good point. Hospitalization costs related to gun violence and firearm injury are estimated to cost U.S. hospitals, this is in 2010, just under $630 million. And this is more than the total cost of the Medicaid program in Wyoming in 2011, which was just about $534 million. And this is according to the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation. And you're absolutely right that when someone visits the emergency room for a firearm injury, they tend to be young males, ages between 15 and 24. They're the most common assault victims. And they visit the emergency room almost seven times more than the national average. And it also tends to be people who reside in low-income zip codes who are twice as likely to have an emergency room visit or be admitted to the hospital for a gun injury. And they're also more likely to be uninsured. So you're right. These costs are enormous.
And then we start talking, too, about lost productivity for people that may be in middle or upper income. So we have lost productivity. We have courtroom costs. We have police, fire, and EMS services. And this is an important point. Because sometimes people will think like, well, you know, I don't own a gun. I'm really not involved with this issue. Well, aside from the fact that you may end up being
a victim,
and as Richard Martinez, you know, whose son was killed, he says, we don't think it's going to happen to us or our kids until it does. And obviously there's families out there because it happens all the time, is that everybody's involved because everybody is paying the cost. Even if you or a family member hasn't been the victim of gun violence because of insurance cost, because of lost productivity, because of a loss of tax base. And we have plenty of statistics and information to show that actually reasonable, sane gun laws are good for the economy.
Yeah, I saw a note on that. And you know, I don't think we're going to have enough time to flesh out how you can reach that conclusion. You know, you could say, well, when there's a sale of a gun, there should be sales tax and so on and so forth, and that's revenue generating. Same thing with ammunition. So there's that piece as well. Just have to put
that
out there.
Any law-abiding citizen that wants, you know, a gun, if they're going through the background check, mm-hmm. and the reason, and again, you know, nobody's talking about confiscation. That would actually be a violation of the Fifth Amendment, but nobody's talking about that. I mean, people are still going to buy guns.
Well, couldn't you say that by changing the rules on, like, the number of the magazine size, in a way, mm-hmm. was that not a form of confiscation? Because they're preventing you from using something that you've already purchased.
No. If you take the the New York Safe Act, which passed in January of 2013, if you possessed a magazine prior to the 1994 federal assault weapons ban that was in excess of 10 rounds, what the SAFE Act asks you to do is you have to sell it within a year, either to a firearms dealer or out of state. You can't sort of resell it inside New York State because it's illegal. But if you possess an assault rifle, a military-style assault rifle that is now illegal under the New York SAFE Act, the old definition of, you know, the AR-15 that was used
right.
in Newtown, you can keep it in New York State. All you have to do is register it. And we've had gun registration in our state for years, you know, handgun permits, pistol permits. So that's a small thing to ask individuals to do for a weapon that in the wrong hands can cause such mass destruction. And it's a military-style weapon. And high-capacity magazines, I mean, I know hunting law in New York State, you can have five bullets in the magazine and one in the chamber.
Mm-hmm.
That's six. The New York Safe Act said seven, so I always say that's an extra bullet. And what are you hunting? You're not hunting deer, you're hunting people. So seven should be perfectly adequate. And also if you had shooter training, so people were more comfortable handling guns. One thing I always say to people is that law enforcement and military, they are experts in firearms. And it's interesting to look at practice, just on our military bases here in the United States. At Fort Hood, you know, they've had two shootings recently. General Milley, who's the general commander at Fort Hood in Texas, was being interviewed after the latest shooting. And he was asked if there's any concealed carry on military bases. And he said, no, there is not. It's not allowed.
It's all open carry.
No, no carry. No concealed carry at
all.
You're not allowed to have personal firearms.
Personal firearms.
No. In fact, all firearms are registered on a military base. And the third thing he mentioned is that all guns are safely stored. And this is a hallmark of training for law enforcement and the military, that guns are stored safely. You know, they take the magazine out, they store the ammunition separate from the gun, particularly around children or other individuals who should not have access to them. This is best practice in law enforcement and the military. And I see it as a gold standard. And so why shouldn't that apply to civilian gun owners? After all, we should protect our children from accidents, from suicide. Often suicide is an impulsive act. And particularly when you're talking teenagers, the teenage brain is not fully developed until you're 25 years old. So there's a lot of scope there for the hormones to go haywire and to grab a gun and do something in haste. And that's pretty final. There's a 13-year-old boy who committed suicide just last year. The day before he was playing video games with his sister was perfectly fine. He finds the next day his father's loaded 9mm handgun, and he committed suicide. And it took everyone by surprise.
Yeah. You know, Frank, and if we could, and I think that's important that we talk about Nicholas's Law.
Yeah.
And because we just, you know, we just had an incident here in Albion, and where a young man finds a gun and shoots his brother. Now, the parents are arrested, but I think it's interesting to point out that there is no legal responsibility for them to have that gun secured.
There's no criminal legal responsibility. Exactly. There can be civil.
You know, I doubt they're going to sue themselves or their son's going to sue them.
Well, but the neighbors.
Yeah. And we got, you know, and it full,
it's
we
doable, believe me.
Yeah. Oh, of course. But there's no statute that says that this is really the social norm. In addition to that, to keep in mind what they were arrested for had nothing to do with the gun.
Endangering the welfare of a child?
Yeah. No. If that kid had taken that gun to school and shot another student, as we've seen 74 times since Sandy Hook, the parents may have been civilly liable, but that really doesn't send the message that it should, that a loaded gun is a big responsibility. And it's not just about you and your kid. It's about our kids and your actions.
Yeah, I know that when our boys were young and they wanted to go on play dates, we checked with the parents just to make sure, hey, do you have a vicious dog on the property? You know, subtly, you know, respectfully. And
Or do you have seatbelts in your car?
Yeah, and do you have a loaded gun in the playroom? I mean, you know, let's give us the quick preview of Nicholas's Law. And this is the Child Safety Act, and it's mostly designed for proper, safe, best practice storage of firearms. Is that right?
I mean, gun violence is the second leading cause of death amongst American youth. A child is killed or injured every half hour in the United States. So Nicholas's Law merely requires, and there are 28 states plus the District of Columbia that have some form of safe storage law regarding guns in the home. So, and New York doesn't. We have safe storage if you have a felon, a domestic abuser, or someone seriously mentally ill living under your roof, but nothing about storing your guns safely around kids. So it's named after Nicholas Nomkin, who was a 12-year-old child in Saratoga Springs who was on a play date December 22nd, 2010, and his playmate's father had guns that were unsecured and loaded around the house. The child found one of these, pointed it at Nicholas, didn't realize there was a bullet in the chamber, fired it and killed him, hitting him in the head. So Nicholas, his parents obviously were completely devastated. The father who owned the gun paid court costs and a $250 fine, no criminal liability. Mm. And in fact, today the case in Saratoga County, the trial, the civil trial is getting underway. So all it requires is what I was saying earlier is for if you have a gun, you're a gun owner, and the gun is not in your immediate possession or control, you should have it stored safely, so that children and other people who should not have access to it can get to it. And that's all that it says. So safe storage means putting it in the gun safe or making sure it's secured in some other way, locked up.
Keeping the ammunition and the gun separate, is that part of it?
It could be, or you could have your gun in the ammunition as long as it's locked in a secure gun safe. It's defined in the bill. We have a Senate sponsor. The Senate bill number is 2788, and we have an Assembly sponsor. The bill number is A-8293, and it's going to be one of our legislative priorities in the next legislative session, and we're going to be pushing it very hard, working with Oksana Nomkin, the mother of Nicholas. We've developed a statewide coalition of organizations, including the New York State PTA Association, the NAACP, the Children's Defense Fund of New York, the League of Women Voters, lots of mainstream groups, Westchester Children's Association, who are backing this very common sense law. Again, why shouldn't civilian gun owners be as responsible as military and law enforcement personnel when it comes to safe storage?
Okay, let's go back to the phones again. Our guest for this hour, Leah Gunn Barrett, Executive Director of New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. The number is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Harmon has a question on gun sales laws. Harmon, welcome to Connections.
Hi. Could you explain a situation that I've heard about, but I don't think I have the facts exactly straight, and that is where, I guess, out because of the hysteria that if the government knows who has guns, that's the first step towards confiscation, the government isn't even permitted to have computerized records of gun sales, and when there has to be an investigation to trace a gun, they have to go to the dealer where they have paper records that they have to search through by hand the old-fashioned way, and it's a huge handicap and slows down, and the investigation makes it much harder to find what they're looking for. I probably don't have this 100% right, but perhaps somebody on your panel can explain that in more detail.
Okay, well, Harmon, appreciate the call.
Yeah, Harmon, thanks for the call, and this is Gary Pop again. I'm a retired police officer, 30 years. And recently I had a long conversation with an ATF agent. And as someone that's conducted investigations into gunshot deaths and assaults, again, this is another example of an industry that has undue influence. The ATF has loops that and things that hindrances that hurdles it has to overcome that no other law enforcement agency is bound by. Interestingly enough, after 9/11, there was all law enforcement was flush with money, but this industry actually got the budget cut for the ATF, and that's interesting of itself. And so, if I was out doing an investigation and it involved gun violence, I could call an ATF agent. And if this was happening, like, say, on a Friday night, he might not be able to look at a record until Monday morning when he could go to a gun shop and look through paper records. I don't think anybody thinks that's reasonable anymore.
I don't know any other industry where paper records have not been replaced.
No, and some of them are computerized, but it would still require the agent to go there. In regards to confiscation, that's really a straw dog. My wife and I are both gun owners. I'm a gun owner. I mean, I've worked with guns. I've had guns since I was 13 years old. I made my livelihood with guns. I still have a pistol permit. My wife has a pistol permit. Guns have been registered. Handguns have been registered in this state for generations. And if they've been registered in other states for generations, and there's been no such thing. That is simply a scare tactic. And again, because property, again, is protected not just by the Second Amendment. It's also protected by the Ninth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment. Mm-hmm. And if we could take one step back, Frank, in regards to the safe storage, because that's what we really want to emphasize again today too, there's a lot of flexibility built into that. Even if someone, you have an individual believes that he needs a loaded handgun at the ready for the home invasion, which we hear, there are many, many products. I invite anybody, all you have to do is go to one of the local gun shops, or some of the outdoor sporting places, online catalogs. There are many, many safes that have biometric locks. They have like a simple push button lock, they're very safe and secure. They're very sturdy. They can be locked screwed into a wall in a closet. And it's the type of thing where, because nobody would have access. One of the things I was always wary of and why my guns are always in a safe, you won't find a gun laying around in my house, because I was always concerned that if I'm out and a burglar comes in there and steals that gun, I don't know how I would live with the fact that that gun was used to kill a fellow police officer.
Yeah. What about the argument that, the gun, what prevents us from being tyrannized by the government, and how do we fight back? I mean, that is a big part of the argument against gun control. In other words, one of the reasons we need to have all this weaponry is so if Washington gets so out of control that they start, it's not entirely, I mean, the federal government can be wrong and they can be abusive and blah, 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 but that argument is there. We can't ignore it.
Well, there's a couple of things on that. First of all, and you know, you and I both as students of history know this, that there is nothing in the Constitution, there is nothing in our history, despite what we are told, that gives us a right to rebel.
Yeah, it's called treason, and it's
called
punishable.
And that's in Article 1 of the Constitution.
Yeah, there are actually four places in the Constitution that specifically forbid insurrection. If anybody, like the NRA or SCOPE, thinks that the reason the founders had ownership, the Second Amendment, was so that we could rebel against the government, it's just a historically indefensible position. And we can go back as far as George Washington putting down the Whiskey Rebellion. We can go to the Slaveholders' Rebellion, a Civil War. And we can even go as recently as a Republican President Dwight Eisenhower sending the 101st Airborne to integrate schools in Arkansas. There is no right to rebel. This is a democratic republic. We solve things at the ballot box. Power in our country does not come from the barrel of a gun. It comes from this, radio shows like this, where people can speak their piece. That, you know, that whole argument is, I would suggest people really need to think about what a revolution and a rebellion would mean. And if I could just finish this up.
Yeah.
We saw what it meant in Las Vegas.
Right.
Two dead police officers covered up by the Don't Tread on Me flag, and at the beginning of the revolution. I don't know exactly in this crowd who thinks that they're going to be the individual that decides the revolution is starting. That's not how we settle disputes in this country.
Yeah. Well said, Gary. Well said. Anything to add, Leah?
Well, I just think of, speaking of Las Vegas and Nevada, Clive Bundy recently.
Yeah, Clive and Bundy.
Yeah, who had his militia with assault rifles threatening federal agents who were merely trying to get him to follow the law. He was grazing his cattle for pennies and not paying what he should have been paying for years. He was freeloading on the federal government and intimidated them, and they stood down because they didn't want anyone to get killed or hurt. But this is a sort of this is not a good example to most Americans of how we solve conflicts and issues. We don't do it at the barrel of a gun.
Yeah, I mean, that's
certainly not the barrel of an assault rifle.
More folklore as much as anything. And I think Mr. Bundy has been pretty much discredited as a beacon of reason.
I hope so.
Well, he was on. There was an NPR story on about. Yeah, Mr. Bundy again today.
Yeah, okay. So what if anyone is going to? Okay, you're going to be at the First Universalist Church tonight, Leah. Right.
That's right.
Again, Leah Gunn Barrett, Executive Director of New Yorkers Against Gun Violence, and that's at 150 South Clinton Avenue in downtown, at 7 p.m. Okay, and is free and open to the public.
Yes.
Okay, and what would people expect when they go there tonight? What would they expect to hear?
Well, we're going to have a discussion. I'm going to talk about the New York Safe Act. I think there's been a lot of misrepresentation about what the law actually is, and again about Nicholas's law and why safe storage is needed. And hopefully we'll have a good discussion about this issue and what people can do personally to make an impact and to get involved and to make their community safer. It's really about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've been finding is it's very difficult for local governments to do anything about this issue. And gun violence is an issue that's crossing all cultures, all races, colors, creeds, economic status. It's not a city problem. It's not a county problem. It's everywhere. And that, you know, we believe that one of the best ways to address this right now is at the statewide level. We've been making a lot of progress in this state towards this. The evidence is in. And we would like to make sure that we continue in the right direction.
Okay. Did you get a chance to cite some of that evidence of the Safe Act?
Yeah, I was just thinking we should probably just mention that briefly. First of all, it's been subject, the Safe Act, to a few lawsuits, and it's triumphed so far in federal and state court, being upheld as fully constitutional, and that it protects the public safety. You hear people say it was passed in the dead of night. It wasn't. It was passed in the afternoon. The governor used a message of necessity, which is quite common when he judges a bill to be of sufficient importance, and this was right after Newtown. New York was the first state to take action. So yeah, enforcement trends are still early days. It's not even been a year and a half since the law passed. But, you know, we've had a number of individuals who've been charged with crimes under the New York Safe Act between March of 2013 and May of 2014, which is where we have data. Most of them were charged, about 78%, with criminal possession of a firearm, which is a Class E felony. And 36 people were charged with possessing a weapon on school grounds. We want to try to keep guns away from schools. I guess people generally agree that's a good idea. And local authorities have revoked outstanding pistol permits of about 83 people who were disqualified under federal law from possessing firearms. So, and also there was a 4.5% drop in shooting deaths in 2013 versus 2012. I don't know if you can attribute that all to the SAFE Act. A lot of it's because we have strong gun laws, but I would anticipate that the SAFE Act, which now has universal background checks on all gun sales, which is arguably the most important aspect of the SAFE Act, 5-year renewable permits, all of that is going to make people safer. It's going to keep guns out of the wrong hands and protect New Yorkers.
Yeah, Frank, if I could just add.
Just, you have about 30 seconds.
I think, you know, one thing to keep in mind, too, aside from the background checks, is this renewal period on the permit is huge for law enforcement. I mean, consider in New York that somebody could get a pistol permit and have that for decades without anybody ever checking. And I can tell you from personal experience, we would have people that would stalk women, have issues, and this and that, and they would still have permits. You know, even a conservative state like Utah, and there's many permit holders in New York that have Utah pistol permits, they, as conservative as Utah is, they have a 5-year renewal period.
Yeah, it would be like getting retested for your driver's license
exactly. Every
so often. I mean, your skills deteriorate and such. So anyway, the music means that we're out of time. Leah Gunn Barrett, Executive Director, New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. Gary Putup, retired from the Sheriff's Department. Thank you both for being here tonight, and we'll see you tonight at the First Universalist Church at 7 o'clock.
Thank you.
Okay.
You're huge, man.
All right, very well. All right, I am Frank Sigelski, sitting in for Evan Dawson. Today on Connections, we have another hour of Connections coming up with Edith Lank, so stick around. Back in a flash, this is WXXI, WEOS, the WXXI mobile app, and WXXINews.org.